Hello, TripCast listeners. This is State Representative Terry Canales at Edinburgh, Texas. I really can't believe I had time to do this TripCast intro, seeing as how busy the House of Representatives has been passing so many important resolutions on the House floor. Is this what we're going to do all session? Anyhow, welcome to the TripCast.
Thank you, Representative Canales. This is Reeve Hamilton here with the TripCast for the second week of February. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Yo.
Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Managing Editor Brandy Grissom.
Good morning.
Is everyone adequately hydrated for this TripCast?
Hydrated.
You're making a Marco Rubio joke?
No. I'm just inquiring as to your health. We do cover a lot of health care here at the Tribune.
You can reach for water and nobody even knows.
Nobody even sees it. That's exactly right.
I do think, I haven't heard anyone talk about what he actually said, which I think is too bad. They just
he gave a good speech, yeah. Actually. If you got past the schwitzing and the reaching for water.
But drinking water is a healthy thing to do. It shouldn't be mocked.
We've become, the Nelson character on The Simpsons. We've become a nation of Nelsons. Ha ha. It's, that's the only thing that comes out of these deals.
That's what we look for.
Entertainment.
I guess that's right,
Well, and so we're, of course, talking about Marco Rubio's response to the State of the Union address on Tuesday night. The big Texas angle heading into the State of the Union address was Ted Nugent's inclusion, which the Tribune and everyone else got some flack for covering from some people. Well, why does it matter that Ted Nugent is at the State of the Union or not? Or does it? Or is it just fun?
We reported last year on Julian Castro being in Mrs. Obama's box at the State of the Union. He was no less of a stunt.
Weird stuff is news.
Right? But that's a stunt. I mean, having him there was a stunt. The point was, hello, Hispanic community, I'm with you. That was a stunt that the president was perpetrating.
That was not the message of Ted
Mark
Nugent.
Mark Vesey, this year, as I understand it, brought an undocumented person as his guest to the State of the Union. That is a stunt.
Right.
Nothing wrong with it, but that's what it is. Ted Nugent accompanying Steve Stockman was a stunt. And the reason that Ted Nugent was relevant was because we're in the midst of a debate over guns. The president used very emotionally, he used the gun issue as a component of his speech last night. There were a lot of Newtown family members and family members of other people who'd been victims of gun violence in the audience last night. Ted Nugent was symbolic in his appearance. Symbolism is part of the State of the Union always. It matters, and I don't think it was any less worthy of a stunt than having an undocumented person or Mayor Castro there. Right.
But including the Mayor Castro does signal something about his potential political future, which spins forward in a way that Ted Nugent does not. I think as Dave Weigel and Slate noted, his last big hit was in the 1980s.
Yeah, but the point of Ted Nugent was for Steve Stockman and for other people in that with that opinion about this stuff to sort of put a banner down, and I think he did that. We're with Ted Nugent. Ted Nugent represents, this point of view on guns and all of this kind of stuff.
Point of view.
It gets a bunch of attention from people like those nerds doing that podcast at the Texas Tribune, and so our point of view gets out there.
I don't see why, frankly, it's not news.
Yeah, it's
it seems to me to be absolutely news and worthy of being reported, and the people who complain that we're giving Ted Nugent oxygen, I think, don't appreciate how journalism works. This is
gave oxygen to Gabriel Giffords too.
Plus, he got a chance to threaten one of our interns, which is kind of a good lesson for an intern to learn.
Right.
You have not interviewed Ted Nugent unless at the end of the call Ted Nugent has not threatened you in a profane fashion.
I've talked to Ted Nugent a few times, and I've always found him to be pretty nice.
He's never threatened you?
No.
Not one time.
But he's told me some threatening stories about others.
Well, okay.
Cautionary tales from me.
What I wonder is if the people that were complaining
you
about...
You, too, could be that wild boar that I deballed this morning.
You can't say deballed on the internet.
I can say deballed any damn time I want. Deballed. There you go, okay?
Oh, this is terrible. I do wonder if the people that were complaining about Ted Nugent being covered are the same people that are making fun of Marco Rubio for drinking a sip of water.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's all the same.
Yeah, right. It's a nation of Nelsons.
It's all the same.
is there any big takeaways, Texas-wise, from the State of the Union that we have right now, just a few hours later?
Has the stack up president's against a liberal. I mean, and right?
News.
That is news to some people.
And therefore, we're likely to see the same,
Not the same.
Texas versus the federal government stuff.
Yeah, that
we, but I mean, there was nothing in the president's speech that told me that Rick Perry or the elected leadership of the state are going to in any way back off their position, that the president and the administration are not welcome in our business. There's nothing that I heard that tells me that we're heading toward any more amicable relationship than we currently
are. You know, you guys probably did too. I had this, you know, deluge of emails after the thing. You know, here's how I feel about the State of the Union speech. They were just, you know, all the public officials, all the members of Congress, and it was, you know, you could, if you took the headers off of them and didn't know who they came from, it's like, that's a Democrat, that's a Republican, that's a Democrat. It's like, it's the same fight.
The usual
well,
suspects.
The best were the embargoed reactions that were sent around to reporters before the speech.
Well, to some extent, I mean, they see the speech before. I mean, you know, this is all kabuki theater.
It wishes it were kabuki theater. Well, kabuki theater is more graceful and professional than what we see in
this is kabuki theater.
I mean, this is
Tripcast.
This would be kabuki theater. Yeah. I mean, the reality is
you don't know that Ross is wearing eyeliner.
The public thinks that this happens in a certain sequence because they see the sausage, but we see the sausage being made.
Right.
Right? And we know that there's embargoed copies
mixing
and that
metaphors.
There's press response. Shut up.
The sausage also has eyeliner.
What were you saying?
Brandon, the sausage had eyeliner, Brandon said. Worst Joyce Carol Oates short story ever.
What? It probably was one.
Well, speaking of the State of the Union, yeah. Perry was not at the State of the Union. He was in California.
Right.
His magical mystery tour out there where he isn't telling people what business he's visiting, but he's visiting some businesses.
I just got off, this is Wednesday morning, I just got off of the conference call he had with reporters from, I guess, on his way out of California. Then apparently they had a dinner last night with 200 business leaders, and his pitch was, look, you know, California has higher taxes, more regulations, and fewer available workers than Texas does, and it's natural that I would go there and try to get people to come in. I'm going to compete with every other state. I'm going to compete with every other country. We're going to do what we can. And I'm not poaching, and if they want to say I'm poaching, that's fine. And thank you for making our $24,000 radio buy worth $1 million by complaining about it. It kind of went through the whole riff. And he also pointed out, and you know, this is actually a pretty good point. You know, we've been doing this for years. He hasn't done the radio ad before, but he said Texas has been going to California and New York and other places for years asking for business. He didn't say this, but, you know, it goes all the way back to, you know, previous governors. Stan Richards made a big deal out of it.
He has a point as far as it goes.
Right.
Where he's wrong is to say, if in fact he said, I'm taking your paraphrase of this as being what he said, he is poaching. There is no other way to describe this. He's poaching.
He's stealing eggs.
It's not job creation. Right. It's job theft. Now,
but he's not poaching beyond how he's poached in the past.
It may be exceedingly artful job theft. It may be no different than what he's done in the past, right?
Right.
You know, he may be the Willie Sutton of job theft, right? You know, he's not just an amateur at this. He's a professional. He's a legend. But it's poaching. It's poaching. Okay. But it is.
Is there anything wrong
with
that?
No, there's nothing at all wrong with it. It's fine.
The turn he has a hard time
just
making.
Just don't pretend
Ted
it's
Nugent
not.
Will get on you if you complain about poaching.
I think the turn he has a hard time making is that this is perfectly acceptable and expected of governors.
But
when you're a president and you have to create jobs and not move jobs from here to there and there to here,
then it's a different
proposition.
Unless you're stealing jobs from Uzbekistan,
right.
You know, you're not actually adding jobs to the job roles.
Well, and Obama did this in the State of the Union speech when he said, you know, Apple's moving some stuff back. He's talking about, you know, that's his version of poaching. But the problem Perry has is
there's nothing wrong with what the governor's doing. It's just it is poaching.
When he goes on the national stage and says, I'm a job creator, that's where you have to sort of say, wait a minute, let's do a little bit of counting here. How many jobs did you create? How many jobs did you transplant from other states? And
well, he would argue, though, that transplanting jobs is creating jobs because the jobs didn't exist here and then suddenly they did exist here.
Well, that would be true if you're just measuring Texas. But if you're looking at the nation,
he is only measuring.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. If you run for national office again and say, I'm a job creator, everybody's going to say,
you're a job rearranger.
Right. I think that's probably too complicated for most people to think. Whereas if you look at one number one year and then a higher number another year in Texas, they will say, oh, he created jobs. I don't think they'll be like, but wait a second, what happened in Nebraska?
So does that also mean then that if Perry were to truly create jobs here, he would have to go to some other country and bring them here in order for it to translate on a national scale?
It's too complicated. We don't do that sort of thing.
I actually think it isn't. I think it's pretty simple. I think what the governor is doing, is, as Ross says correctly, has been done for years and years by governors, not just Perry in Texas and not just in Texas.
Well, in the 80s, California raided
but
Texas
elsewhere,
like crazy.
This is what happens. Honor among thieves. Fair is fair. This is what happens.
Right.
And if Jerry Brown can't, or whoever the governor of California may be, can't organize the political business in that state in such a way that companies want to remain there, then it's bad on him.
Right.
But, you know, I think beyond this question of whether or not Perry should be thinking of this as poaching, it's fair game for him to be there.
Is it the case that this whole – so it became sort of a controversy or media thing, right?
Jerry Brown took the bait.
This is the first time that we've seen Perry do what he failed to do in his campaign and actually control a news cycle in a sort of a way he wants it to go.
Oh, he totally won the – wouldn't you say
– Oh, he killed
– completely.
He totally won the news cycle.
Yeah, and what Jerry Brown helped. I mean, Jerry Brown came in and –
What did Jerry Brown say again?
He said, you know, why are you – he got irritated with his Capitol press corps and said, why are you guys covering this? This isn't a burp. This is barely a fart. A word we couldn't get in the New York Times, by the way. But, you know, it's a governor saying it. And he said that and, you know, everybody went, oh, that's colorful. We'll write that. And the $24,000 radio ad, which is a nothing radio buy, suddenly turned into $1 million worth of free media in all the California papers, Texas papers, New York papers, national papers.
Had Jerry Brown just ignored the governor, this would have been a one-day story.
Right.
Yep. Now, the Sacramento Bee editorialized beyond the burp and fart business.
Right.
What went
beyond that?
Well, they editorialized.
How much deeper can you go?
They brought in gallons of gasoline to pour on this thing and said, you know, Texas is just whining.
That's dangerous.
Right. Hard to argue that, that the media's job isn't to pour gasoline on stuff.
Yeah,
that's what
they
do.
You know, and they went off. And you know, in the direction that Brown was going, but in much greater tone and, you know.
Right.
Didn't Matt Engel here buy his own California radio ad?
Matt Engel?
They had an ad. It's not clear that they actually purchased time. They might have. They were trying to get traction for, it's sort of a howdy partner. You may have heard from Texas that we're trying to steal jobs. Well, that's not the whole story. And it was basically.
Can you do the rest of the TrueCast in that voice?
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll bring a guitar.
You sound like the rich Texan on The Simpsons. Just pow, pow,
pow. I can do that.
This is Simpsons Day here at the TrueCast, isn't it?
What's that pay? That might be fun.
We got to get Mo to do the intro, actually.
You know, you run the risk when you do that, as a Texas Democrat, of running down your home state in another state. You know, it's sort of like taking the fight away from the dinner table. You go to California and you say, Texas isn't that great. It's like, wait a minute, did I just say Texas wasn't that great?
No, they were pretty careful to say, you should come to Texas, but just don't like Governor Perry if you do.
So Greg Abbott wants to take guns from New York and bring them down to Texas.
Right.
And or gun owners, maybe more accurately.
Right.
And Perry wants to take business... or business owners from California move them here. I guess they're properly targeting blue states, although they would say that the conditions that make it unattractive for gun owners or business owners to be in those states are blue conditions, probably. And if
right,
they were Republican
right.
governors, well, we wouldn't have this.
Right.
Right. I don't see them attempting to steal anything from New Jersey.
Our state
Florida,
officials are giving wedgies
right,
to other states.
Because you've got Republican governors there, and maybe right. the theory is different.
If the governor doesn't come back with a handful of California jobs, is that a failure for his trip?
Well, he's not likely. He's not going to get them at the duty-free shop at LAX. It's going to take a little time to get them back.
No, but what will happen is, at some point, somebody will come out from California and, you know, come to Texas, and he'll say, see, the sales job. You know, one of the things that Brown said that got completely buried in this was, you know, Texas Instruments just opened a new manufacturing facility in California. And it says Texas right there in their name. You know, he got buried. He lost the war here. Lost the battle.
The last thing California stole from Texas was Mark Udoff. I'm not sure that worked out very well.
Who's stepping down?
Yes, has stepped down. I think he's gone to teach at Berkeley Law School.
Yeah.
You know, he found that running the University of California system was a mite bit more challenging than running the University of Texas system.
Which is super
conditions,
easy.
Conditions were not.
Super easy. Yeah.
Yes, hugely easy.
Yeah. Let's move on to more somber news, shall we? Brandy, this is where you step up and update us on the Michael Morton, Ken Anderson affair and your travels up north last week.
I did travel far north last week, all the way to Georgetown.
Took you 2 hours.
Williamson County, Texas. Yeah.
So last week was an unbelievably emotional and at times bizarre week in the courtroom.
Same here at the office.
That's just a normal week here. If you don't know, Ken Anderson is the subject of a court of inquiry that is looking into whether or not he should face criminal charges for his role in Michael Morton's wrongful conviction. Michael Morton spent nearly 25 years in prison for his wife's murder, which DNA testing showed in 2011 that he did not commit. And since he was exonerated, Michael Morton and his lawyers have been working to hold accountable Mr. Anderson, who they say withheld really important evidence in the case that, if it had been made available to Morton and his lawyers at the time of the trial, he may not have been convicted in the first place. So among those items of evidence is a transcript of a phone conversation in which Michael Morton's mother-in-law tells a sheriff's department investigator that Michael Morton's three-year-old son had seen his mother murdered by a monster who was not his father. Another key piece of evidence was a police report from neighbors who said that they had seen a man driving a green van get out of the van near the Morton's home and go into the woods behind it. So he appeared to sort of be casing the home in the weeks before the murder. So last week, from Monday all the way through Friday, we heard from the key players in this case. We heard from Michael Morton talking about, the brutal experience of living 25 years in prison, not being able to see his son, who was 3 years old at the time that he was convicted. We heard from Michael Morton's lawyers, who said that there is no way that Mr. Anderson told them about this critical information. If they had, then they would have traced down those leads. And one of his lawyers in particular said that he felt for these last 25 years that he had somehow failed Michael. It was really just emotional to listen to someone who's been plagued by that for the last 25 years. And perhaps the most bizarre day was the last day of Friday, and that's when Ken Anderson took the stand. And he was angry, he was indignant, and although he offered a vague sort of, I don't think you can really call it apology, but a statement to Morton, who was in the front row of the courtroom, he said, that he understood in some way what Mr. Morton had gone through because of his own experience over the last 18 months of having been falsely accused of withholding this information. And so he said,
is he going to go spend another quarter century in prison?
I think that's what
complete the circuit.
That's kind of what the court of inquiry is about, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if he's not, I don't think 25 years is really on the table, but if he is charged, he could potentially be arrested if the, if the judge finds that he did commit a crime, he'll be arrested. So,
Is it in fact a crime to withhold evidence in a situation like this?
Yes.
So the what he's being accused of, which is not providing to the defense or to the court the evidence of these possible other leads, would be enough for him to be charged with a crime and possibly sent to jail. That really is a legitimate option here.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the actual offense that he is charged with, there are three main things. It's contempt, and that is based on the Morton's lawyers say that
he could be charged with.
He could be charged, right. Sorry. So he could be charged with. The Morton's lawyers say that there was an order in the case from the judge back in 1987. The judge said, I want you to turn over this evidence.
Right.
And the whole dispute, really what everything was about last week was whether or not A, this order existed, and B, whether or not it called for Anderson to turn over all of the evidence in the case or one specific report from the day of the murder in which Michael Morton was interviewed by police. So, I mean, much of the sort of minute-by-minute daily discussion was going over these 25-year-old transcripts to try to decipher exactly what the judge had intended for Anderson to provide. So, actually, until Thursday, just my impression sitting there in the court was, Anderson's lawyers did a very good job, I thought, of really creating a lot of doubt about whether or not this order actually existed and whether or not Anderson had been required to turn over that information. And whether or not he actually could have told Morton's lawyers at the time, hey, in discussions, you know, the kid saw this, or, you know, there were reports from the police about this, and maybe just not actually giving them the documents. But then Anderson got on the stand Friday, and it just completely changed the entire tenor of the proceedings.
Were you expecting a different Ken Anderson to take the stand? Or was this, do we get what you would think you would get from Ken Anderson?
I mean, I don't know that there were really any expectations. I didn't, from his previous statements, I didn't expect him to get up there and admit necessarily that he had done anything wrong. But what I didn't expect was really the level of anger that he displayed on the stand. At one point, Rusty Hardin was showing him some comments that he had written in his own book, Crime in Texas. And
this is Ken Anderson's book?
Ken Anderson's book.
And who's Rusty Hardin?
Rusty Hardin is the prosecutor pro tem who's appointed to present the evidence in this case to the judge. And so, you know, Mr. Hardin is showing him this book, and Anderson didn't appreciate the way he was describing a chapter in the book. So he literally, like, yanked the book from Mr. Hardin, his hands shaking. He started to read from the book, like, loudly read each item in the table of contents to prove his point. It was 6 hours of testimony that was just full of a lot of frustration and bitterness on his part.
But, you know, I mean, he is fighting for his life to some extent, right? I mean, he's fighting for his reputation.
Yeah. Right. I agree with you. Right. At a minimum, right.
Well, he told, I think Randy, you'll know this, he told, I think, the Statesman in 2002 or 2003 in a political story, I think when he was running for judge, that this was the case of his life. That the Morton case was, you know, of his career, this was the big one. And here they are not only taking apart what he thought was the biggest prosecution of his life as a district attorney, but saying not only was the outcome of the case wrong, there's some question as to whether it was wrong because you intentionally withheld evidence.
Yeah, and that's really what's at the center.
I mean, they're really going at the heart of his reputation.
I want to observe that I think as interesting, maybe not more interesting, but as interesting as Anderson's emotional reaction, his anger, and his defiance, is that Michael Morton has managed to maintain a level of equanimity that seems superhuman to me through all this. This is a guy who would have every reason to feel wronged and to act out.
He either became very zen when he was in prison. I mean, he must have gone through all the cycles of
grief. You've interviewed him a bunch of times. I had the opportunity to interview him for TV about 7 or 8 months ago, and I have to tell you, I could not fathom that he was this calm and this willing to accept what had happened to him and not want revenge or not want some retribution against Anderson specifically. Well,
the interview Randy had on our site with him, the video interview last week, was, he was placid almost.
That was after a 10-hour day.
He
was like, well, we're going through a process, you know, it'll work itself out.
So let me ask your sense. You guys have both interviewed him. Is your sense that he has gone through all of this and he's kind of at peace with it, such as it is? Or is your sense that he's been at this and thought about this for so long that he's got it completely contained and bottled up?
Well, one of the interesting things that he said right after Anderson's testimony, right after the sort of part where Anderson spoke to him directly, at the end of our interview, a group of us talked with him about his reaction to it, and he said something to the effect of, you know, what he said, that statement to me was shocking, I didn't expect it. I have to go and figure out how to wrap that up inside myself.
Hmm.
So, you know, I think that to a large degree, he is very zen. He's had a lot of time to think about this. He knows that what he wants is sort of this larger sort of goal of accountability and system changes. But I think at the same time, sitting there listening to what he listened to from surrounded by his, you know, fiance and his mother, it's pretty emotional.
So does Ken Anderson not concede his innocence at this point, or does he just not concede that he did anything wrong?
You mean, does he not concede Morton's?
Does he not concede Morton's innocence? Yeah,
he concedes that Morton is innocent. He said that he doesn't think that he did anything wrong, and he told Morton in that statement that he doesn't see anything that he could have done differently to prevent it from happening.
And so, does this case speak
to that's the whole ballgame right there?
Yeah. Does this case then speak? What are like the larger issues with the legal system that this that are at stake here, or is it just these individuals at this point in time happen to be sort of the wrong folks in the wrong spot?
I think you're going to see some legislation pretty soon that will come directly out of what happened last week. One of the points that Mr. Hardin kept sort of hammering home on is this idea of open file discovery. Right now in Texas, prosecutors are only required to give over a very small amount of information, and only if defense lawyers ask for it. And so I think you'll see some proposals that have been on the table in the past but haven't made much progress to have reciprocal discoveries to where both the prosecutors and the defense lawyers open up their files to one another. And that could potentially prevent situations like this from happening in the future.
Both sides are kicking on that, aren't they?
Prosecutors have actually said in the past when this issue has come up, we're fine with it. And there are some prosecutors' offices that already do it in different degrees. Tarrant County is probably the one with the most open file policy. But it's actually been defense lawyers who have been hesitant on this bill because they say they have fewer resources, their clients have the right not to incriminate themselves. They say that, we're already at a disadvantage. We don't have the resources of the state, and so we don't think it's fair for our side to have to open up our files.
Right, but the issue is not wrongful defense. The issue is wrongful prosecution. The motivator in all this is that the prosecutors are somehow keeping things from the defense guys. It's weird for the defense guys to object to a system that would give them greater access to prosecution files.
Well, if they have to give up their own files.
The concern is wrongful prosecution.
Part of the thing is, let's say, your guy is accused of murdering somebody during a robbery at the 7-Eleven, and in order to, part of their defense is going to be that, I didn't murder the guy, I did rob the 7-Eleven. You don't want your guy to confess in a file that he robbed a 7-Eleven.
And then have to turn it over to the
prosecutors.
Look, I think to Reeve's question, the larger issue, there is of course a larger issue at stake here. Mm-hmm. And that is that there are a lot of people who are thoughtful policymakers within the field of criminal justice who say that we have a system that too often causes innocent people to go away or to be sent to death row or, God forbid, to be put to death. It's possible to believe in the death penalty, but also to be concerned about the mechanism of capital punishment not being administered in a way that provides the maximum amount of fairness, because even one innocent person being put to death is too many. And you can extend that downward to say that a system that causes Michael Mortons to go to jail for 25 years for crimes they didn't commit is a system that's broken. We can have a tough criminal justice system, but also accept the fact that there are procedural issues that we have to confront. And prosecutorial misconduct is only one of the issues that is tied up in this notion of whether the system is broken or not. This Anderson case, I mean, we'll have to wait for the resolution of it, but we've been talking about this Morton case in this office for how long? I mean, the idea that this evidence...
Well, we've been around for 3 years.
The idea that this evidence has been withheld from Morton's defense team, that was withheld from Morton's defense team, there just doesn't seem to be any way to look past that or to forgive it or to accept it.
Is it realistic to expect 100% infallibility in the legal system, though?
No, but it's reasonable to expect that all the slop would be on the side of, if you err on the side of fairness. You accidentally don't execute a murderer rather than accidentally execute a non-murderer.
And, not every case is like the Willingham case where, the guilt of the person may not be as much the issue as the treatment of the person in the system. The Willingham case is about whether he did it, but it's also about whether the prosecution of Willingham relied on a jailhouse snitch who didn't really set up as a reliable witness and who subsequently recanted, but ultimately it was the snitch's testimony.
Questionable arson science.
And science. I mean, it wasn't really so much about guilt or innocence as process. There are plenty of cases in which the issue is straightforwardly innocence. And again, you can have a very tough criminal justice system, but also respect the fact that it's got to be the case that innocent people get deference and treatment to the greatest extent possible.
Right.
Well, that's one of the things that all these DNA exonerations are beginning to show us is that there's so much more. It's beginning to reveal all the potential problems out that allow people to become convicted when they're innocent.
Right.
So we can deal with eyewitness misidentification. We can deal with, withholding of evidence, and we can deal with wrong forensic science and all of these things. It helps us to find out what problems exist so that when we run out of DNA evidence to go back and test, which is likely to happen, there are all these other things that we can look at to figure out where we can improve the justice system.
Right. All right. On that note.
On that up note.
Yeah.
Always bringing joy to the room.
Yeah. Yes, we should. If you had
Buzzkill
any...
Brandy, was happy to be part of this conversation.
Gruesome, gruesome.
No, but that was good. That was a good discussion.
I like Brandy Gruesome. That's actually good. Mine was good. Great. Yours was better. Yeah. Right.
That's Simpsons, Adam's motto.
Simpsons theme continues.
It does, exactly.
You got a nickname.
This is like Treehouse of Horrors. That's exactly right.
If anyone out there has questions or comments for the TribCast or any suggestions on how to improve the criminal justice system, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. We would also like to...
We really don't want your suggestions on that.
Or a nickname for Reed. Send those
just
to
send
that
them
same
to
address.
Rodney Ellis. leave us out of it.
It's State Senator Rodney Ellis, Democrat of Houston. Ross, I thought you were going to jump in there.
Yeah, no, you're doing a good job.
We also would kindly request that you go and review the TribCast on iTunes. Go into iTunes and search for Texas Tribune TribCast and then write a review. Email us at tribcast@texastribune.org. You wrote a review. We'll send you a hat or whatever we have.
Coffee cup.
What is that? Bribery? That's what we're doing here.
Yes.
You can also get the TribCast on. Let's look at this email I have here.
There's Steve for service.
Stitcher,
there's hat for service.
Zune Marketplace, BlackBerry Podcasts, SoundCloud, the TexasTribune.org. Anything I forgot?
It's probably that thing you didn't step in on the sidewalk yesterday.
Right. Look at this.
Yes. If you'd like, we'll just come and chat in your living room.
Yes. Absolutely.
On behalf of Evan, Brandy, Ross, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
You understand that when you talk about spittoons, I just love it.